Hello, and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, darling, we've been away, it's been restful, it's been restorative, it's been full of memories, light the corners of our mind. How about you? How are you doing?
It was nuts. It was absolutely nuts. It was crazy. And boy, those Oscars, Brian, can you believe how that all turned out?
Oh my God, we never would have guessed.
Can you believe when that happened? I can't.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of those moments where we're recording something before you know what's gone on in the world. So, you know, the Oscars, Kim Jong-un, Bob Mueller, we're in the dark.
But yeah, my chemical burns are only beginning to heal.
You know more than we do. But Shawnee baby, we have been away. We've been on an extra long hiatus.
Yes, which is necessary to keep the quality of the podcast consistent.
Not to mention to rehydrate, to try out new skincare products.
Yes, I'm using retinoids. It's my new resolution in 2018. We watched a few films simply for pleasure.
Yes.
That was nice.
Brian indulged in a 4.5 hour screening of Fanny and Alexander.
And I watched so many YouTube videos, you wouldn't even know what to do with yourself.
But now, after all of that, we're back doing what we do best, which is watching the work of a single actress and talking to you, the listeners, about the good, the bad, and the crazy.
I would like to say from the start that Brian and I made a very comprehensive spreadsheet. It has color codes, people were dragged up and down. You know, we are really taking this seriously.
This is really curated. This is curated within an inch of its life. When talking about something that is perhaps overthought through, where every detail is precisely chosen, there is no room for spontaneity, everything is completely micromanaged, then of course there's only one actress we could be talking about.
It's Madonna, isn't it?
No, Sean. It's another singer, actress, director, mogul, but one from an earlier generation. Of course I'm talking about Barbara Streisand. Now, Sean, since we last covered Barbara Streisand, I have learned much more consistently to pronounce her name properly.
Yeah, sand on a beach, Streisand, because I believe in the Yentl episode, you did say Streisand quite a lot.
I did. I really did. And this is...
It's
shocking. It's really shocking. I mean, as someone who spent hours upon hours of their high school years listening to Barbara live from Madison Square Garden, I really ought to know that it's sand with an S.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm learning. We're all learning. We're changing. 2018 is a year of growth. So I have been a Barbara Streisand fan since that time, since my high school years. I have enthusiastically sung along to the Yentl medley in my used Volvo as I drove to school.
And yet you were never beaten up. This is one of the most fascinating things about your idyllic childhood. It's the lack of violence that was not leveled on you.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was suburban Massachusetts.
Good luck growing up in Kentucky with that attitude, young man.
We all know, Sean, that I have been a Barbara Streisand stan for all that time. What I think listeners may be surprised to learn is the amount of Barbara Streisand that has been twirling through your Spotify playlist, particularly in the last few months.
Yeah, I will complain about this. So, during the Christmas period, holiday season, whatever you want to call it, I listened to a lot of Barbara Streisand, because at Christmas time, you know, you want to feel enveloped, you want to feel cozy, you want to feel warm, you don't have to leave the house, you just got to indulge yourself. And what better way to do that than with the Barbara Streisand Broadway album playing constantly.
Now, Sean, but this is the thing. This is where you have to really come clean, because if it was just the Broadway album or even Back to Broadway that you were listening to, but there were days, I mean, we were holed up in this flat. There's nothing to do in London at Christmas except hang around. And from the other room, I'd be like, these are deep cuts of Barbara Streisand that I have never heard. Until Sean went down these wormholes, I had no idea that Barbara Streisand had done a cover of David Bowie's Life on Mars.
Yeah. Well, Brian, as you know me quite well, you know that I get these very short-term obsessions. You know, things men, that kind of thing, you know? And, but I should point out that I only listened to this Life on Mars cover once, and I never have to hear it again.
It was from an ill-fated Barbara album, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was called Butterfly. It was one of the John Peters produced things.
We're going to talk about John Peters and his pernicious influence in her life, I'm sure. But right now we're talking about Barbara Streisand Good.
Yes, and Brian, if I may say something, I was listening to the wonderful RuPaul What's the Tea podcast last week, months ago.
They're our podcasting role models.
They are. And they had Billy Eichner on it, and Billy Eichner was talking about his love of Barbra Streisand, but how his parents also loved Barbra Streisand. There was no, why is my kid into this gay shit? Because for them, Barbra Streisand was just this big, popular star, great entertainment, great voice, all-around family entertainment, okay? And so for many, many, many different people, there's many different stages of Streisand. So for me, my first indication of Barbra Streisand was her being the punchline to things, The Mirror Has Two Faces, and Tell Him with Celine Dion. And even being a child, I was looking at it thinking, this is not cool. So I know that she has her disco period, I know that she has Oscars, I know that she, you know, is adored by the Clintons, all this kind of stuff, okay? But that was my introduction to her.
So were you saying then that you came into your first Barbara encounter at a time that, frankly, the product she was giving to the world was subpar?
Yeah, and she had that, you know, that haircut she had, the 90s one, which is this very, very, very thick bob, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Streisand that I...
Frankly, Hillary had the same haircut.
Yeah, Hillary had like 25,000 different haircuts, though.
So did Barbara.
Because the public just, you know, couldn't really take to any of them.
Barbara's hair, someone could write a PhD thesis on it, even in just the way we were. But, okay, so you came as a Barbara skeptic.
And I've been a Barbara skeptic for a very long time.
Okay, so has that shifted and changed, and if so, why and how?
Well, no, it's taken a lot of re-education.
Or deprogramming, as I like to call it.
Deprogramming. And it's partly because she's had such an incredibly long career. It's kind of baffling to think how long it's been. As she pointed out in one of the many interviews I watched with her over Christmas, she sang Happy Days Are Here Again to John F. Kennedy.
Wow.
Okay? Like, that's how long ago she has been around and famous enough to sing for presidents.
Mm-hmm.
So I need time to get a full overview of just who she is in our cultural history.
Yeah, and I think you're right to say the Billy Eichner anecdote, because there is a time when an entertainer like Barbra Streisand or some others were sort of American popular staples. You know, it wasn't like a sign of a niche, gay, old-fashioned interest. It was kind of mainstream populism. She was covering the American Songbook. She was in movies that were big. She was winning Oscars. Her albums were bestsellers. And then somewhere along the way, Barbara became old-fashioned and old hat, and she didn't keep up to date. And so the only people who stuck with her were sort of middle-aged retirees who moved to Tampa and Broadway show queens.
Yeah, and I found it very difficult to understand why she was so famous if she just covered songs all the time. Like, that was really very, very difficult for me to get my head around. Like, that's all I thought she was.
Well, as she herself, I'm sure, would be the first to point out, that is absolutely a blinkered view of her career.
Yeah.
I mean, she started out as a Broadway star, so she originated Funny Girl. Yentl is full of all original music. She has an Oscar for quote-unquote writing, co-writing Evergreen. You know, I don't know about Barbara's actual skills as a composer, but she's definitely originated a number of songs. But, you know, I mean, for a long time, all musical artists were quote-unquote cover artists if they did standards. I mean,
yeah, but I didn't
Billie
know standards
Holiday,
were.
Ella Fitzgerald, you know,
The Great American Songbook, like, I know
people,
that now.
Yeah, they're cover artists, as you would put it, but it's not in the, like, singer-songwriter tradition, you know? It's a different type of entertainer, and it's, frankly, probably an entertainer that's sort of going out of style.
Yeah, most definitely.
I'm intrigued by the fact that we're talking a lot about Barbara as a singer, and I think in some ways, when people are giving Barbara her you know, begrudging due for her talents, they'll often say, well, that voice is like butter, like no one's had a voice like her. But that is the beginning of then a whole series of phrases where they're going to tell you all the other ways in which they find her irritating, annoying, and over-aggrandizing.
Yeah, okay, I'm not entirely in that camp, but I would never dispute for a second how talented she is.
Second to none, Barbara Streisand is an amazing singer. One of the most amazing voices of the 20th century. And she's preserved the voice well enough that even if you're watching that Netflix special that we didn't get all the way through, the music, the memories, the magic, or whichever order it was in. Yeah. I mean, her voice definitely isn't what it was, but she's also, I mean, how old is she now?
She's like 70 plus. Yeah. Although I will say, you know, Cher's voice is still pretty quite good.
Okay, but Cher is definitely doing things with vocoders and God knows what. Barbara does not do that. Barbara has preserved her voice better than a lot of people. So I think we can put her clearly on the Mount Parnassus of singers. But, you know, it's a bit like Susan Sontag. Bear with me here, okay? Mm-hmm. Susan Sontag, widely admired as a public intellectual and an essayist. You know, if you asked her to talk about her own work before she passed away, she's, you know, wants to promote herself as a short story writer and novelist. She wants to be seen as a writer of fiction, whereas, you know, a lot of people would say, well, the nonfiction was always better than the fiction. I think it's similar with Barbara Streisand. She's so exemplary as a singer. She made her name as a singer. I think she sort of, at a certain point, decided she wanted to move away from that. She wanted to be anything but known as a singer. She wanted to be an actress, a dramatic actress, and then she really wanted to be a director. And she is both of those things. Whether she's as good at those things as she is as singing is a kind of open question.
Yeah, okay. Now, I proposed something to you, and you said, well, can you say the same about Terrence Malick, for example? Which is that Barbara Streisand has only directed a handful of films. Three. And where she differs from Terrence Malick, my friend, is in the quality and artistic integrity of those three pictures.
Well, okay, let's, in this Me Too moment where we're talking about women's careers and how they've been hampered, I think it's fair to say that Barbara Streisand, you want to hold her to the standards by which other big stars who branched out into directing are held to. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So comparing her to Terrence Malick, comparing her to Martin Scorsese as a director, or even, you know, Jane Campion, is maybe not the standard. Comparing her to Robert Redford, Clint Eastwood, Kevin Costner, Mel Gibson, all those men that I just mentioned, Warren Beatty, each of them has an Oscar for Best Director. Barbara does not.
Yeah.
They've all had the opportunity to make many more movies than she has. Could Barbara have made more movies in a less sexist Hollywood culture? I don't know. Are some of Barbara's movies better than Braveheart or Dances with Wolves? Probably.
Okay, it is true that, you know, Mel Gibson, Warren Beatty, Kevin Costner, they all put themselves at the center of their film, of their own films. So I can't criticize Barbara for being a director who also cast herself. But the thing is, take Warren Beatty, for example. Last year, Warren Beatty had that film that completely tanked, Rules Don't Apply, or whatever it was called. Now, I don't know where he got the money for that, but I would say a lot of it was financed on the fact that he's Warren Beatty and that he has a lot of money. But I would say that the Benning Beattys don't have near as much money as Streisand does. Brian, I guarantee you look incredulous here. There is no way. Like, every time Barbara Streisand is played on the radio, she gets a check, okay? Warren Beatty has no songs, you know? He doesn't sing. He missed an opportunity there. Okay?
He raps in Bulwark, but anyway.
And also, and now I'm following you part two from the Dick Tracy album, don't forget. I'm breathless.
Okay, so where are you going with this?
Where I'm going with this is that in the space of 34 years, Barbara Streisand could have made more than three films.
That may well be true, and I think you do have to question. She does star in every single one of her films, and then you have, you know, even now, the proposed projects that keep coming up, things like this remake of Gypsy.
God.
You are like, okay, maybe Barbara Streisand could direct a good movie of Gypsy. She is absolutely, at age 70, whatever, the wrong person to be playing Mama Rose. Like, could we have her direct someone else as Mama Rose, please? And there is definitely a continuous attempt to put herself at the center of her films. I guess what I'm just saying is it's hard to hold her to different standards because so few women who have been celebrities the way that she has have even been given the opportunity to direct films. Now, I will go so far as to say that when I was growing up, any single time that the conversation or the question of why women had not won Best Director or the lack of, you know, directing nominees who were women would come up, the next name that would be mentioned would be Barbara Streisand. You know, this happens frequently at the Oscars. Whenever they needed to, like, pump up a bit of feminist credentials, they'd trot her out. Obviously, they did it when Catherine Bigelow finally won There with Barbara.
They trot her out every year.
And even this year at the Golden Globes, you know, she spoke memorably about it. And there they cut to Greta Gerwig, and there was this, like, trans-historical thing going on. And, like, Barbara has made three films that I'm sure were really, really hard to make. But she is not someone who has dedicated her entire career to the craft of directing. She's not Jane Campion. She's not Catherine Bigelow. She's not Dee Reese. She's not even Sofia Coppola. I'm personally happy that we've now expanded that field in public consciousness enough that this one very particular woman with a very particular career doesn't have to be the atlas upon which all female directors rest, because she has strengths and weaknesses. Yeah.
Do you think that it might have been an issue for her to get her films financed by putting herself at the center of them all the time? Because not only do you want creative control, but you want to be the center of it.
It's a question as to whether she always wanted to be the center of it. Who knows? I mean, I suspect there were producers who were like, sure, we'll let you direct as long as you, you know, star in it. Up until a certain point, probably Barbara being in a movie would draw at least a sizable kind of audience. I mean, you look at someone like Jodie Foster, yeah? Mm-hmm. Eventually, Jodie Foster is directing movies that she's not in at all.
Yeah.
You know, her last couple of ones, she doesn't want to be anywhere near them. And I think it's interesting to ask, you know, could Jodie, who's still quite young, be a new Clint Eastwood who eventually is directing things that have nothing to do with her performing in them? That's what I'm saying about Barbara. It feels like she has no interest in projects that wouldn't have a Lowenstein role. Because the Prince
but
of Tides...
But this is it. Why? Why can she not do that?
I don't know, Sean. It's because, ultimately, Barbara Streisand is an entertainer and a personality. I'm not saying she's not a competent director. She is. And her three movies are all very watchable, and they're all very well done, and they're better directed than many, many movies. No, come on. Don't roll your eyes. Like, if you think back to Yentl, okay, and those who want to know our opinions on Yentl can look back at our previous series and episode we did. It has a lot of laughable qualities. It has a lot of hokiness. But it also is well done in a lot of ways. It has good sequences. It has great shots of Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah, and that's what I always say, is that it's a testament to how few female directors there are by how irregularly the male body is completely adored, in the way that Mandy Patinkin's body is adored in
that
film.
So basically what you're saying is the reason we need more female directors is so that you as a gay man can ogle other men. Yeah.
Well, now you're on to something.
What a great feminist. Call up Simone de Beauvoir. Okay, anyway.
Come on. Okay. It's all about transference.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is Barbara's movies are really competent. They're limited. I don't think any of them is really a masterpiece. And I'm going to go out on a limb here. I don't know that I've ever heard anyone express this opinion, but here it is, folks, for the first time. I think the best Barbra Streisand movie that she has directed is The Mirror Has Two Faces.
Okay, well, let's just give a bit of context to this first. You and I, within the first, like, 2 years of our relationship, tried to watch The Mirror Has Two Faces, and we turned it off.
Now, granted,
it is one of the few films I've ever turned off.
Okay, but part of the reason was because the first file that you found to watch of it had Turkish subtitles, and it was very distracting.
Okay, but it was there. I learned that the word ivalik means marriage. I'll never forget that. I've actually turned off very few films in my life. Another two films that I had to stop watching halfway, interestingly, are Swept Away and W.E.
Barbra Streisand is clearly a better director than Madonna.
Okay, but when we watched The Mirror Has Two Faces on our projector on the big screen, we kind of liked it, didn't we?
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, go back and do a Barbra Streisand film festival. Watch Yentl, watch The Prince of Tides, and then watch The Mirror Has Two Faces. And I suspect that a sizable portion of you will be like, you know what? The Mirror Has Two Faces is a nimble, amusing, light comedy.
With a very sexy Jeff Bridges, oh my god.
A very sexy Jeff Bridges. Some interesting aspects about a marriage between these two people that is like semi-platonic and like interested in sex and identity. There's a delightful supporting cast that includes Austin Pendleton and Mimi Rogers and the great Brenda Vaccaro. Like, there's a way in which The Mirror Has Two Faces is Barbra returning to what she does best, which is comedy and romance. And that is not a slight. I mean, I speak as someone who thinks that Barbra Streisand in the 40s would have been a great star. You know, she's like someone who is great for a romantic drama. She's great as a strong woman who stands out. She's great as a comedian. She's funny. I love her in What's Up, Doc. And The Mirror Has Two Faces, for every single laughable scene, like her lecture in the Columbia, you know, lecture hall, where she's giving, honestly, the most banal insights into, you know, world literature that have ever been offered, it has other moments of pure fun and joy.
Yeah, and it's on YouTube, so I recommend you go and have a look at that, because you will be agog, my friends. Agog.
Yeah, I mean, that is Barbra at the center of an entire massive room of extras that she's directed to laugh at her every Borscht Belt line.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to entertaining lectures when I was in university, but I never whooped at every second line. Give me a break.
You didn't have Professor Streisand.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is Barbra as a director. And I think in some ways, Sean, all of this mushigas, right? All of this edifice of ego that has built up around Barbra has obscured Barbra Streisand, the actress. And that is why it was so fun, so revelatory, and so delightful for us both to watch a film for the first time. Neither of us had ever seen it.
Oh, you'd never seen it?
I'd never seen it. Oh, I've seen clips of it. And that film is The Way We Were. So we watched 1973's romantic drama The Way We Were, starring Barbra Streisand and Robert Redford. Sean, how did you feel about Barbra after that?
I realized she was a star. She was the center of that film. She carried the whole thing effortlessly and with grace, and I thought she was deeply entertaining.
Save loyalist Spain, stop Franco, for world peace now, write President Roosevelt today. Come on, do something about it. Save Spain, stop Franco, stop the slaughter of innocent women and children. Do something about it. Write your congressman, you do it today.
Hey, Katie, what are you selling?
Stop. The ROTC, you can have it cheap. Fascist.
It was also really emotional.
Yeah, it's a fascinating movie. I mean, it comes out in 1973 in the kind of early days of the kind of new Hollywood, the Easy Rider,
Raging Bull
kind of thing.
Pictures
of
the Revolution.
Yeah, we already had...
in every episode we mention this.
We already had The Godfather. We're moving into those bad boy directors of the 70s. And here's Sidney Pollack, Arthur Lawrence, the creative team behind this film, Barbra Streisand. I mean, yes, I know it's a period piece, okay? It's a period piece set in World War II and the years following. But Barbra Streisand is delivering a kind of great women's picture performance, and I mean that absolutely not in a derogatory way. I mean that in an incredibly complimentary way, right? She's delivering a star performance in the tradition of Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis. I mean, wouldn't you say?
It is interesting to know that this is a film made in 1973, but very much with the temperament and the look of a picture from much earlier.
Yeah.
And that, as you said yourself, that's not a slice.
And there is a degree of clunkiness to some of it, but there is also just that same big broadness that we as gay men and women and who knows who else can project their longings and their desires onto the character of Katie Morosky, And I will go out on a limb here and say, like, this is the definitive Barbra Streisand performance, the definitive Barbra Streisand character. And I think it's fascinating. It's not Fanny Bryce. It's not a musical. She's not singing. But she is giving every bit of, you know, the Barbra persona at its best.
Yeah, and she's allowed to be the Barbra persona, allowed to be the star, because she's gorgeous.
She looks absolutely amazing. Gorgeous.
The costumes are fabulous. Everything in this film is flattering to her, and it is all the better for doing that.
It's one of those movies, and again, those 40 stars have it as well, where you're like, okay, they did the costumes of everyone, and then they're like, let's put our star in the best costumes. Like, whether she's in a casual pantsuit, or a gown, or a little outfit while she's doing housework at her Malibu beach house, she always looks stunning. She has several different hairdos throughout the film, right? She has that kind of curly, you know, tight curls, Jewish thing going on in the beginning when she's a young communist, and then there's a lot of discussion about how she irons her hair, and she has those 40s big do's, and she looks great in every single shot, every single one of them. And do you know what else? It doesn't have, like, I think this is peak Barbra, right? This is where...
Oh dear, really?
No, it is, and here's what I'm going to say. So, like, Sidney Pollack understands that he has a gorgeous, talented woman at the center, and he frames her in such a way that he allows her to look great, to do what she's doing, to sing a song that is really a great song and fits into the movie. Yeah, fits into the theme of the movie. When Barbra gets the reins of directing herself, she takes all of that and too frequently bumps it up just to the wrong level. So she sings songs like In the Mirror Has Two Faces that aren't good songs, that don't have anything to do with the movie. She shines lights on herself. Like, if you ever watch a Barbra Streisand movie that she has directed for herself, there's just like a key light like coming through the window that's like dappling her hair and sun in every single shot.
You know, Sidney Pollack is not entirely, you know, innocent in this as well. Now, not to spoil anything, but there is a birth scene later on in Where We Were, and she's sitting there in full hair and makeup, not a drip of sweat on her body, and Brian is like, that woman did not have a baby.
No, but I see, that's the thing. I'm willing to buy that because also, like, it's that same 40s quality, right? Like, you know, Betty Davis, when she's, like, going blind in Dark Victory, you know, like, in a hospital room. Like, no, she doesn't look like someone who's really been sitting in a hospital room. That's fine. I'm willing to buy that as, like, the artifice of a star.
Okay, I know.
It's when it goes to the degree that it's just so calling attention to itself, where you're literally like, the lighting designer has been asked, like, give my star director, actress, performer a halo at all times.
You know, she was on Ellen a while ago, and Ellen sat in a different seat.
Because Barbra wanted to be filmed from one side and not the other. Yeah. And that's where I'm saying she's, like, gone a bridge too far. But in The Way We Were, she is absolutely right. She and Sidney Pollack have collaborated in such a way to make a definitive character and a definitive star turn. Sean, we've talked a lot about how much we liked her and her character in the movie. Who is she? Who is Katie Morosky?
Yeah, well, what is the film about?
Yeah, tell us.
Katie Morosky is a young college communist who is handing out anti-war flyers, ban the bomb, you know, justice for Spain, American fascist pig governments. And she's dowdy and she's frumpy, and all her friends look as if they've been in knitted nappies all their life. You know, it's kind of an exaggeration of what a 30s American communist was like.
Back up, Katie! Yeah, all the way to Moscow!
You can still take communion and like the Soviet Union!
What's cooking in the Kremlin, Katie?
The Kremlin is worried about the civil war in Spain, are you?
The other lead character is played by Robert Redford, who plays a character called Hubble
Gardner.
Hubble Gardner.
Okay. I noticed, okay, so we've got Katie Morosky and Hubble Gardner. The yin to her yang.
The yid to her, the yid to his yang.
We can keep that in, I think. This is pushing the line, the boundary, but let's keep it in.
Okay, so basically, in many ways, she is as Jewish as possible, and he is as waspy as possible in this. It is really created to show the difference between these characters in every possible way.
It's not just their looks and their names. I mean, Hubble Gardner. It's also their milieu, the friends they have, their values. So in that sense, it is that American story about a young striver, immigrant girl who has a certain worldview, a certain politics, but who is also longing for this kind of all-American God, you know, and kind of the push and pull of that dynamic, which both works and doesn't work in different ways. Now, we're going to talk about Redford and Streisand's chemistry, but I also want to point out something that you just did there, Sean, yourself, when you were talking about the synopsis of the movie. You said it takes place in the years of World War II, but then you started talking about the 30s and fascist interventions in Spain and all that stuff, and you did what the movie does, which it starts us in medias res, right, in kind of actually the middle of their knowing one another, and then does this amazing zoom back into how they met. And you were a big fan of that structurally, weren't you?
I am. I'm a sucker for those kind of things.
Well, tell what happens exactly.
Well, I love a film about memory, first of all, and it's wonderful that the song has the word memory as the first word in it. You know, I like that. I love an opening credit sequence. There's not enough of them these days. But I'm an even bigger fan of a pre-title sequence, okay? So there is about 4 minutes of just story being told on screen before we get the song and the stars and everything. So what do we see? We meet Katie Morofsky, who's this, you know, spunky radio producer.
And who's she working with?
She's working with Dorothy Zbornak's husband.
That's right, it's amazing. The amount of kind of incredible cameos from stars we love or dislove, like James Woods. James Woods pops up as a young communist at one point. Dr. Brewster, i.e. George Gaines, also Punky Brewster's father, pops up as a stuffy maitre d'.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the great Sally Kirkland has a small role as Pony Dunbar.
We'll get to Sally Kirkland in a minute. But I was very excited to see Stan Zbornak from The Golden Girls, who has quite a sizable role as Barbara's colleague. They're doing radio broadcasts for the Office of War Information, kind of disseminating out propaganda during the war. And then one night, after a long session of radio recording, he decides to take her out to El Morocco for a drink, where she has her signature drink, which is...
It's like Dubonnet on the rocks, is it?
Dubonnet on ice, yes. So she's sipping her Dubonnet, and across the room, she sees someone.
She sees someone in a naval uniform, and he's this completely gorgeous Adonis, blonde Adonis.
Who's sort of comatose.
Yeah, he's comatose, he's drunk, he's passed out, he's sleeping upright, which she remarks is something that they must have learned to do on the ships. And who is it? Only that jerk she used to fancy in college, Hubble. She goes over, and I gotta say I love this scene, because it really takes its time. She looks at him, and she gently touches his hair, okay? He kind of opens his eyes very, you know, sheepishly and sleepily. And then all we hear is...
and of course, la, 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 la. The cinema gets all misty watercolor, you know, and we go into, you know, earlier in the decade and their years of college. And I think it's quite economical. All kudos to Sydney and to screenwriter Arthur Lawrence, because they quickly convey Redford, the waspy ROTC jock athlete, right, doing track and field and rowing and running past Katie Morofsky, passing out her young communist, you know, fight the fascists in Spain paraphernalia. While this beautiful Oscar-winning song is playing, we're getting everything we need to get about who they are. Can we just dwell slightly on the... Katie and Hubble, the college years, for a moment here. Like, how believable are Streisand and Redford as undergrads?
Not very.
Does that take away from the film?
No, it's suspension of disbelief.
And why are they not very convincing?
Because they're fully grown adults.
With 70s haircuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean... He is less convincing, to be honest.
He looks great in some knitwear, though. Oh my god, Robert Redford. There's a scene where he's got this like tight collegiate sweater on, and
But you know, a lot of these students in the 30s, they would dress like young versions of their parents.
Yeah, they just wouldn't look that old, but yeah. Okay. So, I mean, she's big rah-rah on supporting Roosevelt and fighting against Franco in Spain. How would you describe Hubble? Like, what is his position in the whole pyramid of undergraduate life at this unnamed college?
Well, you know, you said yourself, he's an American god. We see him running track and field, we see him doing rowing, we see him with all his definitely wealthy, gorgeous, waspy friends. Everything seems to come easy to him. He's charming, he's cocky, he's never had a care in the world. He's that kind of guy.
Yeah, it's something actually that the screenplay is at pains to keep mentioning to us. Like, Katie is always saying things like, everything comes so easily to you. Do you have to make an effort at all? Why are you always smiling all the time? And he says things like, can't you just stop? Do you ever call it quits? You know, and it's like this dichotomy between them that she is pushy, she's a striver, he's, you know, laid back and easy and things come naturally. Like, if we didn't get that just from their attitudes, the screenplay emphasizes it. Surprisingly, they also both have ambitions toward writing. While they've been eyeing each other across the quad and at rallies and things like that, they really start to come into their most prolonged encounter over a short story class.
So Katie Mirofsky, obviously, she is this girl who wants to be the best at everything because it's harder to be the best at everything when you're her. She writes this story for the first class of the first semester of the creative writing.
She's tapping away at her typewriter with her picture of Lenin hanging on the wall, you know,
so
burning
relatable.
The candle at both ends, yeah.
And she rushes to class, and the writing professor has this preamble in which he says, you know, the writing professor has this preamble in which he says that the stories that they're going to read out are the ones that represent the best and the brightest. And this one in particular represents a quality and a standard that, you know, people can only hope to achieve in this class. And Katie is sitting there thinking, oh my God, it's me, he's finally chosen me. And then he starts reading a piece from a person called Hubble Gardner, who's also in the room. And Katie is just completely despondent.
I was ready for the thing where, you know, the narrative engine of the thing, of the story, is meant to say that Katie is actually the better writer, but that never comes along, even though their relationship goes on for years and years and decades. It's always sort of implied that Hubble is actually a good writer.
Yeah.
And Katie is not necessarily a great or a natural writer. She has a lot of ambition, and she's like the nudge who keeps nudging Hubble to, like, stay true to his values, his artistic values, and she actually thinks that he is a good writer. We hear little snippets of his writing. The titles of his stories are awful.
What,
like, the first one is, like, the boy with the all-American smile, and then the novel that gets published is called something like A Country Made of Ice Cream.
Really?
Yes, by Hubble Gardner. Would you buy that book? Would Oprah have that on her book club? She probably would.
Yeah.
Oprah 2020. Anyway, so carrying on. Katie is obviously devastated, but they run into each other one night after this memorable short story class. Hubble is sitting by himself in a bar in some gorgeous form-fitting knitwear, and Katie is walking along, and he calls her across the street. This was the first scene where I was like, ooh, in addition to being like a nostalgic kind of glossy picture, there is some real spark and there is some real chemistry between Robert Redford and Barbara Streisand. Would you agree, Sean?
Definitely. And that scene in particular is where he asks her to put her foot on his knee, her untied shoe, in which he ties for her.
It's closer to his thigh, I would say.
It's very erotic.
We've talked a lot about Barbara in this movie. Do you think that Robert Redford is a good counterpoint to her here?
I mean, he's the straight man, essentially. And sometimes all you need to do to make a straight man irresistible is to make him absolutely gorgeous. Because Robert Redford is not my type, okay, even young Robert Redford. But if I was Katie Mirofsky and some gorgeous jock took an interest in me, I wouldn't be able to say no, because why not?
I remember from Pauline Kael's review of this film, which is, incredibly complimentary, as you would expect to Barbra Streisand. Kale was like a Streisand acolyte. She gushes about Barbara's star qualities. The only thing I can remember her saying about Redford is that the editing didn't serve his performance very well. And I actually take issue with that with Pauline. What's interesting is that Hubble is a somewhat recessive character. Yeah. Right? Katie is the one who's pushing all the time. And they're doing these two performance styles in opposition to one another that in some ways shouldn't work, but do work somehow.
Yeah, because she's delivering, in many ways, quite a classic 1950s, 1940s style of acting.
He's doing that very, you know, kind of like Stanislavskian, improvisatory seeming kind of thing where he's like turning every line into like a slight mumble and trying to be natural and casual, whereas she is delivering the lines in this way that is just really well thought out and very delivered. And it's kind of genius because it kind of fits those two characters. And you watch them both. It's like they're looking at one another from across a divide of culture and gender and religion and class, but also acting styles. And yet somehow it works. There is a spark between these two people that you are like, yeah, okay, so in real life she married Elliot Gould, but in the movies, let's have her with, you know, Apollo.
Yeah, let's believe it.
It really works. So all the seeds of this relationship are sown in college. They go away for some period of time. He serves in the Navy. They meet in this night in El Morocco. The structure takes us back to the present day, and he's drunk. She takes him home in the taxi. He ends up crashing at her pad. Can you just describe the incredibly memorable scene where they fall into bed together for the first time and how it happens?
Well, first of all, he comes home. He vomits. She makes a pot of tea. She comes out of the kitchen to find his clothes on the floor leading up to her bed and bedroom. She goes in there to find his gorgeous back looking...
Freckled,
you know.
Sun-dappled.
Inviting us to touch it. And she thinks, oh my god, oh my god. And she takes off her clothes.
And gets into bed with him.
Gets into bed with him.
Now, Sean, two questions. Number one, is this behavior ethical? And number two, would you do it?
Well, I can't really say this on air, can I? I mean, it's at this point where we have to talk about our gay boy fantasy in the form of Arthur Lawrence.
Yeah, okay. And maybe we should say something about Arthur Lawrence. So,
okay.
Arthur Lawrence, a gay Jewish man, most of his famous credits are as the book writer for Broadway musicals like West Side Story and Gypsy. Although he also wrote the script for The Way We Were. I think it was based on a novel that he wrote. I don't know if the novel was ever published, so maybe he took that novel and turned it into the screenplay. He clearly identifies so intrinsically with the character of Katie Morofsky. I suspect that Lawrence himself came from a kind of left-wing Jewish family. He probably lived through a lot of these years in the late 40s and 50s himself. I think he is projecting something of probably, I mean, I'm projecting onto his projecting, but I think there is a way in which Katie Morofsky's obsession with this beautiful, you know, goyish guy is very much the way that a queer kid would lust after the seemingly unattainable masculine ideal of their, like, male classmate or best friend. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could just replace Katie Morofsky with a wimpy, you know, gay boy, and the film would still carry on the way it does, minus, of course, the birth.
And why is that? Because it's like, it's interesting to think about this as if it were a Bette Davis picture or a Joan Crawford picture, because in those movies, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the student of those movies and I'm not, but like, you don't see Betty and Joan like gawkishly pursuing John Garfield and Clark Gable and Gary Merrill, right? Like, this movie is very much from the perspective of while she's bold as a political thinker and a student and a voice, and she's brainy and intellectual, when it comes to men, she just gets weak in the knees and is kind of like, says all the wrong things and blurts it out and like invites him over for a pot roast and buys all this stuff. She's successful in everything except love, and she kind of like overdoes the love. She like bombards him. Like there's
best boy syndrome, isn't it?
She's not hiding her feelings for him in any way. She's completely uncool. And I think maybe that's why there's a high degree of kind of like gay boy identification that is just seeming to simmer beneath the surface.
Yeah, and I don't think we're positing anything too radical here. I think it's just our interpretation of it. We both independently concluded at this.
Question, who would you rather, Hubble Gardner or Oliver from Call Me By Your Name? Which I feel is a quite similar dynamic, actually.
Hubble Gardner, because I think he's richer.
Yeah, he's not like a poor graduate student. But like, isn't Call Me By Your Name basically just like a European art film rewriting of The Way We Were with Elio as Katie Morofsky? It just, and minus all the politics extracted and a lot of like art history and musical theory put in. Yeah,
definitely.
It's the same movie, basically. Mm. So she gets into bed with him. He's totally drunk. He's removed all his clothes. She removes her clothes, although not her makeup.
Yeah. I was like, oh, come on, Barbara.
Those pillowcases.
They're gonna be covered in soot tomorrow morning.
Does this comprise sexual assault?
Don't they have sex?
Yeah, so Hubble, in his, like, drunken state, sort of rolls over.
Well,
and
she encourages him to roll over.
Yeah, well, first of all, she didn't need to get in the bed. She didn't need to take off her clothes.
Did she take everything off? Does she? Yes, she does, isn't she? Yeah, she takes all her clothes off.
And he comes over, he kind of rolls on top of her and starts, like, necking and then, like, having sex. And there's a close-up of her face, and she's like, it's Katie. You know that, right? It's Katie. And there's, like, a single tear as it's, like, the dream that she's long held, but she's not even sure if he's aware. You know, is she just a warm body to him, or does he know that it's her?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you... Again, that again feels like that queer fantasy of, like, if I just am persistent enough and I just wait for the right moment, then this, like, straight guy that I have a crush on will finally someday, in a drunken moment, let his guard down and I may get what I long for. You know?
I think a lot of people have done it, to some degree.
So then the question of, like, exactly how attracted Hubble is to Katie becomes a kind of question throughout the middle section of the film. It's, they do sort of become on again, off again. He shows up in New York. She pushes the question a bit more. He kind of comes closer. He kind of moves away. He kisses her and tells her she's beautiful, but he also is uncomfortable with her when he brings her to, like, hang out with his Beekman Place waspy rich friends who don't like her talking about...
Well, she's also deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, because they're always like, why are you lecturing us on Yalta all the time? You know, she wants to talk politics. They want to be flippant and dismissive. It is sort of a question about, like, despite their continued attraction, despite the fact that they seem to get on well when they're by themselves and they're sparring and their jokes and their sex, presumably, all of that is good. It's the world around them that makes it hard for them to stay together.
Yeah. Well, Brian, you know, if the relationship is not destined to succeed...
Maybe everyone's had a relationship like this in their life. That relationship that was right and wrong at the same time, mm-hmm. or was right for a certain time and not right for it forever.
Yep.
And I think that's what makes this very special as a romance movie, because they do stick together and they do get married. Yep. And spoiler alert, they do move to California and have a baby together.
Yep.
But it is only one chapter in their entire life. I'm actually going to cite two scenes that I think are probably the best acting we get from both Redford and Barbara. The first scene from Redford, so his novel has been a success, and he's got the chance to sell it to Hollywood. He's been with Katie. It seems to be going well, despite these issues with their social circles. And there's the chance to move to California. And she's all excited about it. She's ready to, like, dive in deep with him. And what does he do before he decides whether to go on this new stage of their relationship or not?
Now, this is a great scene, you're right. So, he calls over unannounced to a girlfriend of his, one of the blonde waspy girls.
I think she's kind of like even a former flame of his from college days.
Or at least like a girl he might have gone steady with for 5 minutes when they were in college, and now she's just part of the same friend group. And he goes around unannounced and he talks to her, and we can tell that he's deciding something.
He's looking at her paintings, and it's clearly the world he's very familiar with.
He's making a decision, and we're not entirely sure what it is.
He sort of starts to talk to her a bit about, how would you feel about the idea of me selling my book and moving off to California? Does that seem like something you'd like? And she's like, yeah, living in sun and luxury all the time sounds great. And at that moment, Redford flickers, and he's like, this is not the girl for me. And he just says, cool, great, thanks, glad to be here, and walks out, and she looks confused. And the thing is, the reason he sticks with Katie and chooses Katie is because she doesn't choose the easy path. What Katie is saying is, yeah, go to Hollywood, but only for a time being. Sell your novel, make some money, and then we can save up. We can go to Paris, we can be intellectuals, you can write more novels. Katie kind of represents to Hubble the person who keeps him on track. She's like Jiminy Cricket to his Pinocchio. She's like, always let your conscience be your guide. And that is both her great strength and her most irritating quality, right? She is always telling everyone to take things more seriously, to think about things more deeply, and she's just so persistent. And in that moment, Hubble thinks that he wants that. It comes after Katie has what I think is Barbara's best acting in the whole movie, and possibly in her entire career, which is this incredible phone call scene.
Yes, this one-sided phone call scene.
Do you agree about this, Sean?
Well, I think it's the sentiment of the call, the conversation, that really makes it so good. So her and Hubble have had an argument, a public spat, against the backdrop of one of the ideological clashes of his waspy friends.
And he said, I just don't think this can work. I think we're too different. We aren't wanting the same thing, and they actually break up.
And that night, Katie is in her flat, and she's walking around. You can tell she's distraught, and she picks up the phone and she calls. And we don't get a split screen, we don't get a reaction shot. We just have her on the phone, where she calls Hubble and says, I need to talk to my best friend. And I think it's rare in even cinema at that time, and to be honest, a lot of cinema still, to consider that the partner that you're with, the person you love, is like a best friend to you, and not just your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend.
It's one continuous take as Sidney Pollack's camera slowly pans in. And I mean, how many great female stars have had fantastic phone scenes,
yes,
you know, where they're calling,
yes,
their lover and they're trying to hide their emotions. And Barbara is flustered. She covers her eyes. She has a hanky. She's crying. But she's also letting it out, and she's being vulnerable, and she's opening herself up, and she's saying, whatever happens, I just need my best friend. I need to be able to talk to you. Can you come over? I promise I won't touch you. I just need to talk to my best friend.
That is also another coded gay moment.
It's because I'm not attractive enough, isn't it? I'm not fishing, really. I'm not. I know I'm attractive. Sort of. But I'm not attractive in the... I'm not attractive in the right way. Am I? I mean, I don't have the right style for you, do I? Be my friend.
No. You don't have the right style.
I'll change.
No, don't change. You're your own girl. You have your own style.
But then I won't have you. Why can't I have you? Why?
Because you push too hard. Every damn minute. I mean, we don't... There's no time ever to just relax and enjoy living. Everything's too serious to be so serious.
If I push too hard, it's because I want things to be better. I want us to be better. I want you to be better. Sure, I make waves. I mean, you have to, and I'll keep making them until you're every wonderful thing you should be and will be. You'll never find anyone as good for you as I am, to believe in you as much as I do or love you as much.
I know that.
Well, then why?
We've had our fling, we've been together, I know you don't want me in the way that I seem to want you, but can we please be a part of one another's life? I still like the conversation. And I think that is why, despite all this being in some ways a kind of paint-by-numbers glossy romance, it has these interesting, psychologically messy, complicated elements of their relationship. It's exactly what you say, Sean. They... in some ways are two people who should get together and are good for each other and who help one another transform into better people, but probably aren't people who should stay together forever.
Yeah.
And that's why it feels instinctively right.
And I love a love story in which the people aren't together at the end.
Yeah.
Because that's real life.
Now, the movie, in my opinion, kind of flounders a bit. It's not enough to say it really goes off the rails, but it does get bogged down in Hollywood. When they move out to California, they get married, they're on the beach.
This is the point where I fell asleep.
Sean, for all his love of the political, seemed to not be interested in the House Un-American Activities Committee. I mean, basically, Katie gets, you know, she's the wife of, you know, hot young screenwriter Hubble Gardner. There's a lot of plots that's going on with his agent and their colleagues and the ones who have been communists before getting, you know, needing to testify in front of the HUAC and all that stuff. There's a lot of tension, like, will they stay together? Is she being too pushy? Is she ruining his career with all her political activity? And actually, she also falls pregnant.
By him.
Yes, yes. So they're going to have a baby. How do you feel about, like, it does get a bit boring. I think the economy of the writing and the directing here maybe get a bit flabby.
Well, this is the point where I thought that I had fallen asleep for ages. The pregnancy and the marriage part are, you know, gestated and rushed at the same time.
Yeah, because they speed over the fact that they've got married. Then she announces she's pregnant. She seems to be pregnant for a long time in movie terms, and we don't really witness her seeming to physically grow.
But that's exactly it. Yeah. That's why I thought I had missed something, because I knew she was pregnant, but she looked, you know, slim.
There are scenes where you worry that she's going to have one of those horrible movie miscarriages, because, like, they're returning from having testified at the committee and there's, like, anti-communist protesters who are, like, jostling them. And yeah, you think, oh my God, there's going to be some completely unbelievable miscarriage that's going to come from her being, you know, thrown by a crowd. But that never happens.
No.
In fact, what happens is Redford has an affair with an interchangeable waspy blonde woman, which is clearly, I think, because they've grown more distant, they've realized that for all the qualities that have drawn them together, there are further qualities that are pushing them apart.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to this final conclusion as they're sitting in their Malibu beach house. It's not working. They're not made for one another. Hubble can't value their relationship more than he can value his career and his need to, like, live the life that he was raised to lead. Whereas Katie is so committed to her principles, and so they decide to stay together until the baby is born. That's when you're right, Sean. They jump ahead to the baby having been born. Barbara is in the hospital bed, still looking like Elizabeth Arden has done her hair and makeup. The baby's nowhere to be seen. The baby's in another room in a bassinet, and they're both looking at each other for one last time, and then we jump ahead to this epilogue. Do you want to just describe how Hubble and Katie, many people will have seen this scene, even if they haven't seen The Way We Were, but how does it all conclude?
Well, if you've seen that episode of Sex and the City, which is finally coming back to me, by the way, I do remember seeing this. How it ends is outside a fancy hotel. And now, do you know what time this is? Is this like present day 1970s?
No, I think it's probably the late 50s, early 60s, because they're talking about writing for television.
Okay.
And he talks about how it's all live and everything, so I think it's the, like, Paddy Chayefsky years of, like, Playhouse 90 and all that stuff.
But enough time has passed.
And she's out there, because it's clearly that time, right, because she's passing out leaflets that say, ban the bomb, no more Nagasakis. So it's, like, post-World War II, it's the Cold War, basically.
Yeah. And she's handing out pamphlets. She, by pure chance, sees a man exit this hotel with his blonde wife. And there's a pause. Both of them clock each other. Hubble sees Katie. Katie sees Hubble.
Your girl is lovely, Hubble. Why don't you bring her for a drink when you come?
I can't.
And we learn that the biological child, that's Redford's biological child...
he's never had any interaction with.
Yeah, in the end, they didn't name it Eugene V. Debs Gardner. Instead, it's named Rachel Cohen because of Katie's new husband, who's an upstanding, presumably leftist Jewish man.
Yeah.
Hubble's got a new girl. They both got their new lives. It seems like Hubble is nowhere near this girl's life, even though he is the father. Presumably he sends alimony checks.
Oh, God, I hope so, at least.
Yeah, he seems rich enough to do that.
That's emotional to me.
They look at one another, they give a long, lingering hug. He goes off to his fancy hotel and his Stepford wife, and she returns to Pony Dunbar and the pamphlets that are being given out. And the last lines before the theme song recurs again are her screaming, ban the bomb, ban the bomb, you know, and it's like, Katie Morosky will never give up her cause. She has been a key and important chapter in the life of Hubble Gardner. He's been an important chapter in her life, but they just weren't meant to be. And that was the way we were.
Yeah.
The way they were.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a well-done version of that story, Sean?
It is very dated in many ways. It has that 1940s quality to it, but it is a period picture in a sense. Like, it's of a time and it's of the way we were. I think, you know, love stories are eternal.
Mm.
That's so, how you want to
I mean,
them.
It does it fit in with the kind of great Hollywood love story?
Yes, it does. Because it's very well made. It has beautiful people at the center of it who are made to look even more beautiful than they are.
It's nice, like, also that it's about something. Yeah. Like, it's about selling out. It's about, like, political principles.
Yeah, it's an epic, really.
It's about, like, a cross-class, cross-politics, cross-religion romance. So it's not frickin' love story, you know what I mean? Ryan O'Neill and Ally McGraw.
Yeah.
Yeah? Which is around the same time, a few years earlier. Kudos to Arthur Lawrence for making this story about something interesting and complicated. And kudos to the studio for casting Barbara in what really, I would just say, is the role she was born to play. I know she had her previous Best Actress Oscar for Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl. That's a kind of, like, breakthrough role, you know, who is this amazing star? We're going to give her her Oscar on her first go-round. But Katie Morosky is a really mature, controlled, but still funny, compelling, and beautiful role.
It's a shame she had to lose to Glenda Jackson.
In A Touch of Class.
In A Touch of Class.
Oh my God.
Which has a special place in our heart. Maybe you'll hear more about that a bit later.
Yeah, and no slight to Glenda Jackson. She's a great actress. But Barbara gave a performance for the ages in The Way We Were.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of people who've given performances for the ages, we promised that we would talk about a girl called Sally, and we haven't done it. So,
well, you know, Sally Kirkland, the great Sally Kirkland, who was Oscar-nominated for her role in Anna, and who didn't win, she lost to Cher, who has her own special place in Oscar history as a very small role as Pony Dunbar, one of her communist friends.
We were so excited when we saw Sally's name in the credits that I kept for the first, like, 20 minutes of the movie, whenever a blonde-ish woman would appear, I'd be like, is that Sally? Is that Sally?
Well, Sally actually doesn't have blonde hair in this. She got brown hair. Okay.
Who does she play, Sean?
Pony Dunbar.
Why is she named Pony? Is that like a communist name?
No. No, it's not. It's a nickname. They obviously stuck with her.
Do you think Sally and Barbara still talk?
No, I'm going to say no.
Not even at the Golden Globes or the Oscars after party.
I presume the Sally is still invited to the Oscars, isn't she?
I would hope so. Every nominee, I think, becomes an automatic Academy member.
Yeah, but do you think Sally had her... do you think she got a spring cleaned?
Purged by...
No, Sally still works.
By Cheryl Boone Isaacs. She does still work.
Yeah, she does still work. Actually, what am I talking about? Sally was in The Most Hated Woman in America recently.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, so that is Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were. If you haven't seen it ever, or you haven't seen it recently, it gets... two big thumbs up. Get a box of tissues, a box of bonbons, and watch it with someone you love, because it's going to make you weep and it's going to make your heart swell.
Yeah, and a bottle of red wine.
Red wine.
Yes.
It'll be okay.
Shut up, Brian. Well, that was the good Barbara Streisand. I will say to our listeners that the two films in the bad and crazy category, we had weighed up as interchangeable, though I think we've settled on which order they're coming. These films are both bad and crazy.
The other two movies that we've got coming for you in the next two parts are Streisand vehicles, where she is very much at the center. They suffer probably from her over-egotism, but they are not movies that she herself directed. So don't go out reviewing The Prince of Tides or The Mirror Has Two Faces.
Yes, she may have produced at least one of them.
Yeah, both of them.
Both of them, okay. Yeah. So she's not entirely blameless in these.
They are star vehicles in which her star persona does not fit quite as naturally as it did for The Way We Were. You'd have to be crazy not to at least find a bit of guilty pleasure in the next movie that we're going to bring to you. You can find a tease for it at Broad Appeal Pod, as ever, our Twitter account. Please follow us. You can also follow me at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X. And you can leave us a rating or review on iTunes. It helps people see it and it makes us feel better.
Yeah,
really.
Please. If you've stuck with us into this new series of Good, Bad, Crazy, then you could at least take the time to write us a review, couldn't you?
Or just press the stars. Don't write anything.
Just think of all those memories from the Broad Appeals you loved, all those episodes of the podcast. We'll be back in
maybe immediately for next year.
Bye. The way we were.